Hey, before we get started, did you know that you can get continuing education for this podcast? Just head over to academy.flightgrit.com to find out more information. Now let's get on with the show. Welcome to this episode of the Flight Grit Podcast, your place for pre-hospital emergency and critical care transport education. On today's episode of the podcast, we're joined by Dr. Kamasar. Dr. Kamasar is a cardiothoracic and critical care anesthesiologist currently working at Mass General Hospital in Boston. We're excited to have Dr. Kamasar on the show today, where he's going to talk with us about his approach to managing the crashing cardiac patient with an emphasis on airway management. So with that, I want to invite you to kick back, relax, and enjoy our conversation with Dr. Kamasar from Count Backwards from 10.
Hey, what's up, everybody? We're back with our next live broadcast. I'm here with my co-host Hunter and Dr. Kamasar.
Yes.
From Count Backwards from 10. We're super stoked for today's broadcast. We're going to be talking about the crashing cardiac patient. Dr. Kamasar, thank you for joining us. It's really great to have you.
Very excited, as always. Always excited.
I'm gonna let you kind of give a little introduction of yourself, who you are, where you work, kind of what your background is, and then we'll get right into it.
Sure. Cool. So to anyone listening, my name is David Kamasar. I did my medical school back at Rutgers in New Jersey, did anesthesia training there, then went to the Massachusetts General Hospital for critical care, and then stayed for another year of just cardiothoracic and open heart anesthesia. And then I am staying on staff afterwards.
Wow.
A long run.
So yeah, I believe it. Hunter, take it away, buddy.
Well, Dr. Kamasar, we're super excited to have you. We've watched you on social media and kind of followed you, and you put out great content, and it's very awesome to watch and learned a lot from you. So very excited to have you and get this going.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Yeah. Go on.
I said, I'm glad somebody's learning something from my notes.
Definitely, I have a feeling there are a lot of people out there looking at your notes.
So today we're going to kind of talk about the crashing cardiac patient. And what we're kind of talking about is the patient that presents in the cardiogenic shock. This isn't the SCAPE patient. This isn't the patient that we're flooding with nitro or anything like that. We kind of want to talk more about pressors and optimizing them there. So kind of to start, how are you differentiating when you're seeing these patients, whether it's in the ICU or other places? How are you diagnosing these guys? You know, they come in with undifferential respiratory distress. They look shocky. What are things you're doing to really diagnose, okay, this is congestive heart failure and this is cardiogenic shock versus your other shocks or a respiratory distress of other kinds?
Yeah, so it's completely reasonable, especially from your guys' standpoint, because you're seeing them before they get to us. And it's much easier for us because you roll in and you're like, patients in cardiogenic shock, you're like, great. Thank you. I don't have to do any of the work. And so it's weird because it's something that we don't actually think about all that often, except for when we're leaving the operating room and someone is developing it later in the unit. We don't oftentimes get them without that kind of diagnosis. There's a couple of things that I look for. I think the first and easiest, most telling sign is their pulse pressure. So to anybody doing this is the pulse pressure is the difference between the patient's systolic pressure and their diastolic pressure. And as we know, a normal pulse pressure is about 40, because 120 over 80 is a normal pulse pressure. And so if you have a patient who has a pulse pressure of like 10, their arterial line or their cuff goes up and down, and the difference is almost nothing. The way that I think about systolic and diastolic pressure are, if you ever remember cartoons from when you were younger, you'd have like Tom and Jerry and Jerry or Tom, I guess, would step on the hose and you'd see that big wave of like water coming through the hose. Think of that bubble as your systolic pressure. And then whatever pressure is in the tubing that's not in that bubble is your diastolic. And so if you have a large difference in your systolic and your diastolic pressure, it means that your left ventricle is able to generate enough pressure to generate one of those big waves, right? Okay. Whereas if you have a very poor functioning LV, poor functioning LV, it can't generate that nice big systolic blood pressure. So the very first thing I look at is, what is the pulse pressure? Somebody that has a pressure, even if it's like 90 over 40, is probably not cardiogenic because it means that that heart can generate a systolic pressure of 90 and overcome the pressure in the aorta. So that's the first thing I look at.
Okay. Interesting.
Two, I want to look at, you know, the thing that they always tell you is, I forget the mnemonic for it because they tend not to mnemonic, but feel their hands, feel their feet, feel their extremities. Are they cool? Because in most other forms of shock, you know, a lot of distributive shocks, if you're having an allergic reaction, if you're in septic shock, you get vasodilatation, especially in the peripheries, because you get all these like vasodilatory mediators and you get all sorts of kind of capillary leak. And so even though your blood pressure is low, you will get very warm kind of red hands and feet. But if you have cardiogenic shock, it means that your heart is not able to pump blood to the furthest points away from it, those being your feet, your hands. And so classically, these patients will have cool, clammy hands in the setting of this low pulse pressure. And, you know, it's a good indicator that this is probably cardiogenic shock. Other things you'll see, especially if it's an acute cardiogenic shock from something like a ruptured mitral valve leaflet, or something that causes, or mitral valve cord that causes, you know, immediate backflow of volume into the left atrium and back into the lungs, is a lot of these patients will flash. So it's another thing that can tell you if all of these things are adding together, their pulse pressure is low, their hands are clammy, and all of a sudden they get very short of breath. It means that that LV can't generate that pulse pressure forward, and it is instead backflowing into the pulmonary artery and into the lungs. And then I don't know if it's becoming more common for you guys in the field, but being able to put an echo on somebody, a butterfly or a Philips Lumify, and be able to look at their heart and see, is the heart beating, is usually a good indication, you know, because you can see what the LV is doing. And then finally, pulses. Even with low blood pressure, in patients that have a good, strong cardiac output, you will be able to feel a palpable kind of pulse. And when you have severe heart failure, it's not always the case. Depending on where and the reason for the heart failure, the acute failure, you'll see things like JVD and other things like that. So it ends up being a lot of physical exam, especially in the setting of not being able to necessarily do an echo right away or whatever it may be. But that's kind of what I end up looking for.
Nice. Okay. And when you're doing your point of care ultrasound or your bedside echo, are there certain things? Are you looking for like B lines? Are you trying to quantify their EF? What are kind of things you're looking for there?
Yeah, so it's interesting because a lot of point of care ultrasound, both the emergency room, in the ICU, and even our echo training in cardiac anesthesia, a lot of it, because we don't quantify everybody every time. The okay. kind of the purpose, a lot of it for point of care immediate answers is, have I trained my eye to see what an ejection fraction of 60% looks like versus 30%? Do I know what a fractional area change of 50 versus 20% is? Do I know what severe mitral regurg looks like versus mild mitral regurg? And so okay. the reason it's becoming important is because after doing so many and quantifying so many, I don't necessarily quantify so much as I look, because I've seen hundreds of thousands or thousands of echoes at this point. I'm like, that LV is not working at all, and this person, you know, is in florid cardiogenic shock. Or it's like, oh, that LV looks pretty good. This might be a mixed picture or something else. B lines can definitely get you to the idea of whether or not there's fluid in the lungs, but that doesn't necessarily tell you why. Now, it may help support, oh, my LV is not working, and now the patient's short of breath, and they have B lines. Maybe it's not pneumonia superimposed on their heart failure. Maybe it's just volume overload.
Okay. Are there any specific labs that you are looking for in these patients that, you know, other than the obvious of troponin and stuff like that, are there other labs that you're looking at to decipher, you know, how far along the shock they're in, or if this is a cardiogenic shock versus a different shock?
Yeah, so I think the supporting lab for it is going to be the BNP a lot of times, which is the brain naturopathic peptide. And this is a hormone released when the LV kind of gets volume overloaded, gets stretched. I think it's the atria. Release it. And as your levels get higher, it implies that the heart is kind of overfilled. So BNP is a really good marker of kind of what the volume status, not a good indicator of the volume status, but it tells you a bit about the atrial stretch. Along with that, lactate, I think people fall into this trap of like, oh, if the lactate is high, that means they're in shock, which is very true a lot of times. You also have to remember, if the liver's not working, if you have chronic renal failure, things like that, that you may end up with a high lactate anyway because you can't clear it. That being said, lactate is a good indicator of whether or not you're perfusing your end organs or not. And then on top of that is physical examination. That's always going to be it. Is the patient mentating? Is the patient making urine? Is the patient, obtunded or not? And while these aren't necessarily specific for cardiogenic shock, they help move you towards the line of, putting a clinical picture together, which I think is what a lot of this stuff ends up being.
So with a lot of these, heart failure patients, you know, some of these guys walk around with hypotension all the time. So when you're trying to decipher if they're in true cardiogenic shock without putting a probe on their heart, are you looking at, like you said, you're looking at the temperature of their skin, their pulses, and how they're mentating and stuff like that?
So it ends up mostly being a clinical diagnosis. Patients present in cardiogenic shock. You're looking at them, you're talking to them, you're examining them. But like you said, not every facility has the ability to do a point of care ultrasound at the bedside in the emergency room or in the ICU. Not everyone is trained to do it. Not every, transport person is able to do that. And so mostly it ends up being a clinical diagnosis that you're making given the patient's history, given the presenting symptoms. Guy says, I have crushing chest pain, and then they don't become asystolic, but they lose their blood pressure, or they, start getting cool and clammy. They're like, ooh, I don't think this guy all of a sudden developed an allergic reaction to nothing, right?
Right. Sure. Yeah. When you're doing the bedside ultrasound, it is getting more and more common in the pre-hospital environment. Are you looking at the IVC at all for compressibility? Are you looking for their fluid status to differentiate, or is that not very helpful here?
So it depends. So at least in the data, IVC compressibility is really only reliable, at least to my knowledge, and please correct me if I'm wrong, if you see something different, but at the very extremes and the very lows of determining volume status. And when I talk about volume status at any of my lectures, I think of it it's a big picture, right? There are very few things in medicine, despite what we look at as being single points and like, oh, this patient has a CVP of 11, so it's a little bit high, so they must be volume overloaded. Almost everything is putting a picture together. Well, their CVP is 3 and their IVC looks very compressible and their eyes are sunken and the history says they've been vomiting for 3 days. It's like the patient is probably dry. But you're going to have a lot of times where you're in the middle where you're like, oh, the patient's CVP is like 11, but they're a liver failure patient. They have a bunch of fluid in their belly and their eyes look sunken, but they have this tremendous cardiac output. Like, are they dry or are they not? And so when you're ultrasounding somebody, you're looking at somebody, part of the question is if they are in cardiogenic shock, there is an amount of time, right? Your IVC may not back up and get swollen with fluid if all of a sudden you go into cardiogenic shock, because there still needs to be that transit of time where volume and pressure backs up into the left atrium, into the pulmonary vasculature, to the pulmonary artery, to the right side of the heart, and eventually back. And the reason that's important is because you may develop symptoms of cardiogenic shock before you start seeing like plethoric IVCs, JVD, things like that, at baseline.
Okay.
Interesting. Definitely, like we touched on, like, field point of care ultrasound is starting to make its way out into the EMS, even EMS and transport world. And I think what we're starting to discover is the full range of applicability of this tool as a diagnostic tool, in this setting, outside of the hospital setting. So it's interesting to kind of get that additional perspective. I'm curious, with regards to that, are you taking the time out? You've got this crashing patient. Do you feel like you have that there is enough value in taking the time to put the probe on their chest, or are you kind of coming to your determination of how you're going to manage this patient, based on your experience of Gestalt and kind of the whole clinical picture, or do you think that there's enough value in taking the probe and using it?
Yeah, so It's a tough question to answer from the perspective that you guys are in, because for us, I'm in the cardiac OR and then in the cardiac ICU. I know that this patient had aortic valve surgery, and if all of a sudden something starts to happen, I know generally focusing what is going on. It's very unlikely that all of a sudden this person, you know, ruptured their mitral valve for some, or ruptured their papillary muscle for some reason, and now all of a sudden have torrential mitral regurgitation. So going in blind, the reason it's so important, yes, you need to support them. Management and support comes first until you get to a point that you feel comfortable enough to do an evaluation. But at the end of the day, part of the reason it's so critical, at least in my opinion, and these are all only my opinions, sure, is that treating congestive heart failure, like a CHF exacerbation or a cardiogenic shock, with certain medications that you would treat, say, septic shock with, can be devastating, right? Somebody that has severe aortic regurgitation, for example, and now they're in cardiogenic shock, and you say, okay, I'm going to start them on phenylephrine or give them pushes of it, can just kill them. And so being able to differentiate what you're dealing with is pretty important, because, you know, aortic stenosis, even though it's the aortic valve, is managed very, very differently than aortic regurgitation. And so throwing pressors at them, doing one thing, not volume resuscitating them first before moving forward, can result in some pretty catastrophic things. And that's why, even with cardiac anesthesia, the fellowship, I mean, we spend a lot of time very, very meticulously putting people to sleep that we know have severe aortic stenosis. Even then, we are very, very careful about watching everything that we do. So there was a lot of words to kind of go in a circle to say that get a pressure, get something that's compatible with life, or get another pair of hands to look while you're doing it. Because if you have a heart that's slugging away because it's actually, you know, they're having an allergic reaction and it happened very suddenly versus, an MI, it can cause a lot of issues.
So, yeah, great. That's cool.
Kind of recapping what you were saying as far as diagnosing, a lot of value in using POCUS or bedside ultrasound, BNP for labs, patient assessment as far as their skin, and pulse pressure as well for differentiating these cardiogenic shocks from those shocks. Awesome. Okay.
Yeah.
So kind of moving into the treatment, we kind of preface that we're going to do the cardiogenic shock patient, and we can say whatever cause, but we can say ischemia, and we're going to pretend that we're not in a large level one where the OR, or the IR suites right down the hallway. Starting with your treatment with these guys, and as far as oxygenation goes, do you kind of, Is it always non-invasive for you? Are you going right to non-invasive with these guys, BiPAP or CPAP? Are you upgrading from maybe a non-rebreather to high-flow nasal cannula with a little bit of pressure there and then going up there? Or kind of where do you go there with that?
So it depends on the patient's needs. And that was probably an easy cop-out answer. But a lot of times I opt to try not to intubate these patients early or positive pressure if you don't have to, because if we think about the way we breathe normally, you take a breath, your diaphragm contracts and moves cephalad and caudally, and your lungs as a result expand because there's less pressure in the pleural space against them, and that creates a slight vacuum effect between the atmosphere and the lungs, which allows air to flow down a pressure gradient. That is also super important for venous return to the right side of the heart. When you take a breath, as your lungs diaphragm moves down, your lungs expand, there's less pressure on the heart as well. And what this results in is increased venous return to the right side of the heart, which means that there will be increased flow to the left side of the heart, provided that your heart is working. As soon as you put somebody on positive pressure, you encounter two problems. One, you decrease venous return to the right side of the heart, which means you decrease cardiac filling. Two, you make it so the right heart, say you had a big right-sided MI, can no longer generate an appropriate pressure to pump blood to the left side of the heart. And now you're increasing the afterload, because every time you inflate the lungs with positive pressure, you squeeze the pulmonary artery, you squeeze the pulmonary vasculature, and now you get almost no filling from the right side of the heart to the left.
Okay.
In my opinion, keeping somebody as close to physiologically normal or what they are able to walk around and tolerate is the best thing. Your body is very good at breathing and moving blood while you're breathing without positive pressure. And so ideally, keeping them, if it means 100% oxygen, if it means some high flow nasal cannula, even if it means an unrebreather without, you know, a tremendous amount of PEEP or pressure, I opt for that. But then you get into some weird discussions like, is it an acute CHF exacerbation and all they need is some Lasix and some positive pressure to get the fluid off? Or is this like full-blown cardiogenic shock, in which case, you know, you need to decide management is probably a little bit different because at this point, the LV, the heart is simply not pumping. So there needs to be some amount of clinical decision-making is where do we think the patient is and what can we do for them to get them to a point, hopefully they don't necessarily have to be intubated. And that comes into a discussion, which I'm sure we'll talk about later, of kind of mechanical support and things like that don't necessarily require the patient be intubated to oxygenate them.
Okay. So it sounds like, so kind of, you know, least invasive to most invasive, and remembering that non-invasive positive pressure ventilation does not come without insult to the patient, especially a full-blown cardiogenic shock. If you're going to go to non-invasive positive pressure ventilation, do you kind of have tips and trips? I mean, kind of, do you have numbers that you start at? Let's say this is a full-blown cardiogenic shock patient, bunch of fluid in their lungs. Are you starting somewhere with them? Are you just kind of watching these patients and up-titrating your IPAP versus your EPAP, stuff like that? Or kind of where are you starting with them?
I think if you're getting ready, if you're at the point where the patient is requiring high volumes of IPAP and EPAP on a non-invasive, the other kind of side of this is doing something and intervening before it becomes an emergency. Because if you can do it before they are, you know, it's anticipation, right? If you think this person is not going to make it from point A to point B safely, and that they're going to crash in the middle, I would opt for putting the tube in and positively ventilating them with good pre-oxygenation while they can cooperate, while they can breathe, you know, good deep breaths beforehand. And that if you get into trouble trying to intubate or whatever it may be, that you are not sitting there with a dropping saturation. And that goes for any patient, not just cardiogenic patient. If you think a patient is not going to tolerate it, I anecdotally prefer to get a secure airway in, because if I can do it with some amount of breathing room and some cushion with my oxygenation and my saturation, the last thing I want to do is now have to try and intubate them with zero reserve. Because as soon as they go to sleep, as soon as they become apneic, if they already have fluid on their lungs and now you're trying to intubate them, you're gonna hear the O2 sat drop precipitously. And that's not a great place to be in. So again, and cop out is it's always a clinical decision, but you have to remember, and I think we try to memorize a lot of things, is what do you think is best for this patient? If you think you're going to get into this helicopter or get into this transport vehicle and move them, and there is even an ounce of possibility that they're going to crump in the van or in the helicopter, put the tube in, treat their pressures, you know, get volume off, get them Lasix, give them inotropic support, and get them across. But if you have to deal with that crashing airway on top of this patient, you're going to be in a whole lot of trouble beyond that. Also remembering that hypoxia is not free, not just from like the, you know, neuro standpoint, but hypoxia is not good for the lungs because you end up vasoconstricting a good amount of the pulmonary vasculature. It's going to make it harder for your right heart to pump. It's going to make it harder for your left heart to fill. And so it's a balancing act. So a bit of clinical acumen and gestalt and be like, do we think we're going to get from point A to point B safely? And if not, right, they tend to opt for a more conservative approach.
So obviously kind of what you're saying is intubation is not something we love to do with these patients, but don't find yourself in a situation where you have positive pressure ventilation, you're on high amounts of it, and now you have a situation where you have a hypotensive patient requiring high amounts of positive pressure ventilation that now needs innovation. So
right.
do it before you get to that point.
I think it gets you into trouble. I think if you're transporting a patient that's requiring a lot of PEEP before going from hospital A to hospital B, there should be a strong consideration for intubating them before making the trip.
Okay. Okay. Well, that's good to know. You kind of want to touch on the kind of more curiosity on the non-invasive patient. I'm sure you do it as well. Do you ever use a degree of sedation with these patients to increase their compliance with the mask? Do you try fentanyl, ketamine, Versed?
Yeah, so we don't have a ton of it. Part of the rationale is patients who are on BiPAP or CPAP or non-invasive, one of the absolute, even though not everybody unfortunately follows it, contraindications is that the patient has to be awake and alert and oriented. And the reason is BiPAP forces air down somebody's throat. If the patient, you gave them fentanyl or you gave them something and they become nauseous and they vomit, they will inevitably almost immediately aspirate because it will just push air into their face. And so I want the patient, even if they're uncomfortable, awake and alert as much as they can. If they need a little bit of Versed to tolerate it, fine. But you need to be very careful about that because the sedated patient cannot breathe with the mask. And again, you run into this issue of even with ketamine, the patient may breathe spontaneously, but they cannot protect their airway because reflexes are not kept intact with ketamine. So it's very possible for them to regurgitate, to vomit, to whatever it is. There's no reason to think that any of these patients are not full stomachs, for example, especially in like an emergent situation. And then it's very possible for somebody to just vomit and you're in a lot worse position.
Okay.
No, that's cool. I just wanted to add something there. You know, it's interesting you mentioned, you know, the hypoxia and the effect on the heart, right? Because we talk about hypoxic pulmonary vasoconstriction and the effect that has on our patients, you know, with shunt physiology or dead space ventilation or, you know, whatever it may be. But I think it's really interesting what you talk about, how when you're preparing these cardiac patients for intubation, that, you know, yeah, we know that hypoxia is good, you know, bad for the brain, it's bad for the organs. But it's interesting that what you point out is that, I don't know, for whatever reason, you don't hear it talked about too much, that if you induce hypoxia during your apneic period or whatnot, now you are adding more strain to the heart, not just because of the hypoxia, but also from the sequelae with the vasoconstriction of the lung. So that's a really interesting point. You know, there's a concept that we talk about in transport a lot, and I'm sure that it's not just in transport. It's this predicted clinical course, right? And I hear it a lot when I talk with providers. You know, they talk about all the indications for RSI, but they oftentimes will fail to recognize that predicted clinical course is also an appropriate indication. It is better to manage that airway prior to them being hypotensive or being hypoxic, right? Like you said, it gives you that cushion so that you're not behind the eight ball. So I love that point that you made.
I mean, if somebody is in the operating room or wherever it may be, if I think that they're going downhill, the best case scenario in both situations is, okay, they get a little bit better and you don't need to intubate them, or you intubate them and you know, they get better and you take the tube out, versus the worst case scenario is you've put the tube in and they're not getting better and you move to like more advanced airways, versus you don't put a tube in and they crump and now, you know, borderline asystolic because they're, you know, hypoxic. And it's interesting to anybody, and I don't know what experience you two have had, but even in pregnancy, we will pre-oxygenate patients or denitrogenate patients for 5 minutes before putting them off to sleep if they need to be induced for general anesthesia for labor or for whatever it is. And just from the belly and the uterus, rather, pushing up on the diaphragm and the decrease in total lung volume or lung residual capacity, they desaturate immediately. And that's somebody that has properly been pre-oxygenated. And so, again, everyone is going to kind of have their own threshold for what they consider reasonable or what they can get to and from. But hypoxia, especially in cardiac patients, if you have a poorly functioning RV and you jack up the pressure on the RV through vasoconstriction, you may as well be calling for ECMO at some point very short. Just the RV is not designed to pump, you know, it generates a pressure of 25, not 150.
Right.
And if all of a sudden all of your vasculature in parallel is squeezed off, there's nowhere for it to go.
Nah, I think that's a great point. And probably, one of many huge take home points for people to realize that we're not just affecting, the brain, the heart, and the vital organs, but we are adding additional strain, adding additional pulmonary afterload when we don't adequately, preserve that, their O2 sats.
Cool. Definitely. We'll go on, Sean. So kind of moving forward, as far as hemodynamics with these patients, cardiogenic shock with low blood pressure, let's kind of talk about your pressor choices. Are you going to start with levofed to try and get their coronary perfusion pressure up and then add on your inotrope? Or do you go right to an inotrope and start that? Where do you kind of go with the algorithm as far as your pressor requirements?
Yeah, so it's almost always right to epi. If you are confident or working in a situation where levofed is a great drug, and the beta agonism that it has does provide some amount of inotropic support, even with blood pressure support. But if you're in a situation where you know the right and or left ventricles are not working, epi is the way to go. Epi is a very potent inotrope, and it's going to help vasodilate the pulmonary vasculature, which is going to help move some blood forward bronchioles and stuff to help, VQ matching to some degree. But inotropic support is going to be the most important thing. Now, an undifferentiated shock and you're not sure, levofed is always a good place to start, again, because of that beta agonism and because of its pressure support. You do have to be wary of other inotropic agents like milrinone, things like dobutamine, because they do cause a profound vasodilatory effect. And that's not always, what you want. It definitely helps to move blood in the right direction, but if their blood pressure, can't tolerate it, epi is usually almost always the way to go with pushes as needed.
Okay. So is it kind of fair that you'll optimize their blood pressure and then obviously add on your inotrope, your dobutamine or milrinone to give them the inotrope effect they need?
Even with dobutamine and milrinone, if you're in a place where your pressure can tolerate it, we will start to add on some of those, but very cautiously and very, the saying that I've heard is everyone boluses milrinone once. That's because it really does a number on blood pressure. We use milrinone again in lighter doses when we need. And then I don't know if you're able to in transport, but a lot of times even patients are transported with like Valitri, or other kind of things for pulmonary vasodilation. Nitric oxide can really help move blood from the right to the left side. Provided the left side is able to move blood forward.
Okay. Is there ever a time when you're solely going to use dobutamine or milrinone without the effects of epinephrine? If the blood pressure can tolerate it, or is it always
not in a cardiac patient? Again, my thoughts and my experience is it's epi is always first, and you can always peel it back later. And that oftentimes happens. There's lots of patients who have chronic heart failure that go home on milrinone infusions, and they live like that. But first line, until you get to a point where your pressure is tolerable, I am almost always going to epi first.
Okay. Do you have a preference with dobutamine versus milrinone? We definitely see both a lot in the transport environment. I understand that milrinone is excreted through the kidneys, and the half-life seems to be longer on that one. Do you have a preference because dobutamine is easier to titrate on and off, or is it just luck in the drug?
It ends up being an institutional thing. I think the best place to see this is kind of when patients come off bypass, especially from heart transplants. Everyone has kind of a different cocktail that they use. Some places are milrinone, some places are dobutamine, some places are one or the other. Some places will come off on a little bit of both. I think that milrinone has a much more profound effect on the vasoactivity of vasculature. Dobutamine is a little bit more forgiving, and like you mentioned, doesn't last quite as long. In the pre-hospital situation, I haven't actually been in one, so I don't know what it's like in that situation. But I would be more so for high dose pressure with epi and then seeing, okay, if we're on 20 of levo, 0.04 of vaso and 10 of epi, and they're still just maintaining a blood pressure of like 95 over, 60, they're probably not getting milrinone because they won't have a blood pressure.
Sure.
Even at that point, you may even be reluctant to start dobutamine and may have to move to like mechanical devices because they just won't tolerate it.
So is there a...
That was a good segue.
Is there a kind of still with the hemodynamics, is there a number you're shooting for? Now, I know in the ICU environment, we have swans. We can get, real-time numbers right then and there. But if you're, maybe you're in the emergency department or you're in the transport environment, are you shooting for a systolic, a MAP, a diastolic? Is there something you're looking for?
Two things. One, we want pulsatility. So usually you want at least, I don't want to give a specific number, but 15, 20 points of pulsatility between your systolic and diastolic. The reason is that you need to make sure that your LV is still opening your aortic valve with every squeeze. And then two, a MAP, usually about 60, 65. This number has been discussed ad nauseum. There was a paper that came out last year, the year before. I think it was called Is 60 the New 65, as to whether or not there were differential outcomes in the ICU with MAPs of 60 versus 65. But again, and I know it's a terrible cop-out answer, it's going to depend on the patient in that if you have a patient with a history of CVAs or strokes, I may be pushing for a higher MAP because they need to have that higher brain perfusion. If you have a patient that you're afraid has chronic kidney disease and you don't want to box their kidneys, they may need a MAP of 70, 75 to hopefully prevent some amount of that renal injury afterwards. Whereas if you have an otherwise healthy guy that all of a sudden, had an MI and just has some coronary artery disease, at 50, 65 will probably get you there.
Okay. So fair to say kind of going off our MAP, 60 to 65 is going to be appropriate. And then about a 15 to 20 difference in those pulsatility. Okay.
Yeah. Well, once it starts to place where your heart is not generating enough of a pressure to pump blood out. And at that point, you're going to start, crumping.
Is there any, I just thought I had to ask, is there any role for dopamine at all in the, in these patients or any patients? Just curious.
So dopamine is always contested. And there are certain institutions that use dopamine for every patient. And there are some that use it for no patients. I can tell you conclusively, to my knowledge, there is no data that says that it improves renal perfusion and improves kidney outcomes. What dopamine is good for is increasing heart rate. And the reason this becomes important, not necessarily in acute, it depends on the reason for cardiogenic shock, but you have to remember that the heart is really bad at augmenting its cardiac output when it can't pump well. So after bypass, for example, with cardiac surgery, the heart is very stiff, it's swollen because it's been ischemic. And so if we know that cardiac output is equal to heart rate times stroke volume, and your stroke volume really can't go up because you have this fixed lesion, basically a non-compliant ventricle, the only way to augment your cardiac output and increase your pressure is to increase the heart rate. And so what we do in the OR is we can pace people because we have percutaneous pacing wires, and we can pace them up to a rate of 80, 90, 100 and get their output up and get their blood pressure up. Dopamine is a pharmacologic way to kind of get that same result, getting their heart rate up in order to maintain some amount of perfusion. Now, again, this is important because it depends on the reason for cardiogenic shock. If you're in cardiogenic shock because you just had a massive MI, getting the heart rate up is not always going to be a great choice necessarily, because you're going to further increase the oxygen demand of the heart, make it harder for that heart to pump. It'll become more ischemic, you'll worsen your MI, versus somebody that has, aortic insufficiency, where you don't want them to slow down their heart rate because that leaves more time for diastole, more time for regurgitation, and you actually want to increase their output by increasing their heart rate. So the reason for cardiogenic shock becomes very important when deciding what you're going to do with it and considering what oxygen demand of the heart is like. Same reason why giving phenylephrine to somebody with acute cardiogenic shock, say from an MI, aortic regurgitation, will actually make it worse, because now the afterload is higher, which means blood does not want to go forward. It wants to go backwards, which is going to further fill the LV and dilate it. And you're slowing the heart rate, so you're not actually increasing the amount of output you're producing.
Okay.
Whereas dopamine to somebody with like severe AS, it could just kill them, because all of a sudden their heart rate goes up. Aortic stenosis has this spiral where heart rate goes up because you have a fixed stroke volume. You can't fill your coronaries, so you become ischemic. So your heart rate goes up to try and get more blood out, but then it needs more oxygen because it has a higher heart rate, and it becomes more ischemic, and then you die. So it's very important to recognize, if possible, the reason why this person is in shock, if at all possible, from their history, from an echo that was done before, and why, again, coming back to that idea of why bedside echo is so important.
Sure. Okay. Gotcha. And yeah, definitely can, bedside echo can definitely, like you said, drive your care, depending on kind of what you're seeing. So that's really interesting. That's very helpful.
It's like the question of having a person that's had a right-sided MI, like, what do they always tell you? Like, the mnemonic used to be MONA, right? Morphine, oxygen, nitro, and aspirin. It's like, that's all great, but if they're having an inferior wall MI and you give that person nitro, they have no preload to the right side of their heart anymore, and they're just going to die. Right. So there to be thought conscious decision making as to why you're putting somebody on something or approaching something the way you are.
Yeah.
Okay. Is it kind of safe to say with these cardiogenic shock patients, and again, we're talking about the patient that is hypotensive secondary to a cardiac issue, that fluids and or diuretics are not in this category, versus managing cardiac failure with a good blood pressure and stuff might be helpful there. There's really no point for them in this at all, correct? Or
repeat that. I apologize.
So in the cardiogenic shock patient that we're talking about now, that's acutely hypotensive, versus the other cardiac failure patient that might have a good blood pressure or high blood pressure, with this specific patient in cardiogenic shock, fluid overloaded, is there any time that you'd be giving these guys fluids depending on what you're seeing, and or diuretics or anything like that? I mean, obviously, if they're acutely hypertensive, we're staying away from them, but there's still a role for that.
And so part of that, again, comes down to, and kind of hammering home why point of care ultrasound is important and understanding, is that a patient who's in cardiogenic shock from a ruptured mitral valve leaflet, for example, not leaflet, I keep saying leaflet, cord that causes a flail, and you have this severe mitral regurg, blood flows the path of least resistance. One of the hallmarks of managing severe regurgitation is volume, giving them volume back, because volume will increase the pressure in the right atrium and the left atrium, and make it in part so that blood does not want to flow backwards into the pulmonary vasculature and things like that. Now, it's a catch-22, because the more volume you give, the higher the risk of pulmonary overload as far as volume goes, but you also want to try and prevent fluid from coming backwards. Versus somebody who is in severe cardiogenic shock, who has severe aortic stenosis, and they've had a large MI and they have a dilated left ventricle, you have fallen off the Starling curve. So you know the Starling curve kind of goes like this, and then it starts to plateau. And it plateaus because you're looking at stretch of the heart versus ability to contract. So imagine you have a rubber band and you stretch it a little bit, it snaps a little bit. You stretch it more, it snaps more. But at some point, you're not getting any more snap back from it. The heart works the same way. And as you stretch it more and more, just like kind of an old waistband from shorts, you will reach a point where you won't snap back anymore. And so once the heart is so dilated, it can't snap back and generate that force because there's so much volume on it. They may need fluid off, despite the fact that they have low blood pressure. And it may need to be diuresis plus big time, support from a pressure standpoint.
Okay.
You need to get volume out of the heart in order for it to get back to a point that it can actually start contracting again.
Okay.
Now that's awesome. I love the illustration of like the pressure volume curve, right? Yeah. You give them a little fluid, the pressure comes up, give them a little bit more, but eventually you reach that point of diminishing return. And then you reach that point where they fall off the curve and give them, they just die.
Yeah. It comes down to a lot of times they just die.
Yeah. Yeah. I know we're getting close to our time here. I have to dive in. I have to talk about this patient now. You know, they've basically failed everything. You've decided you have to go to intubation, right? So there's this big kind of concept, you know, in the transport world, and you know, particularly like, you know, for the flight paramedics out there and in pre-hospital, is you know, optimizing the patient's physiology, right? That's kind of been like this catch term for a while, right? And, you know, the National Association for EMS Physicians recently came out with a position paper on optimizing physiology for pre-hospital intubation, right? And they talk about oxygenation and acidosis and managing fluid, managing press, you know, patient's blood pressure prior to the process of actually performing the intubation. And I also recently, so that I don't forget, I also recently heard another educator talk about this process of actually feeling for pulsatility during the intubation process, which I thought was really interesting, especially, you know, the way you put it, you know, when that patient has a failing heart, as long as there is pulsatility, then there's enough ventricular contractility in order to generate forward flow. So I'm curious, like, you've got that crashing patient, right? You know, their sats are, you know, in the toilet, you know, their blood pressure's crap, they're acidotic. You know, what are you doing? What is your process that you go through to optimize them before you actually pull the trigger, push the paralytics, and actually pass the tube?
Yeah, so this is something that we deal with in a lot in our intubations, and it's probably one of my favorite things to talk on, is kind of airway management in the critically ill. And it's like, how do you go about doing this? I think the first step is always checking a pulse, because I like to know what that baseline pulse is. The reason is, especially for you guys who don't have an A-line, and I've gotten into arguments with people about this, where they're like, oh, you're saying that if you feel a pulse and then all of a sudden you don't feel a pulse later, you're going to start CPR. It's like, well, maybe if they have a thready pulse and the cuff is cycling, then yeah, I might end up starting CPR. but I don't know what that baseline pulse feels like, because when we go to put the tube in shortly later, I want to know if things have changed, because if all of a sudden I don't feel a pulse anymore and that cuff is cycling, I'm like, we have changed something dramatically. So I want to know my baseline. So obviously cycling of pressure before. Three, if you can give them bicarb, if they're super acidotic or acidemic rather, and it will help, because remember that as you become more acidemic, your pressors do not work very well. So you want to, like you said, optimize. If you can optimize their pH, get their pH up, it will help your pressors and inotropes work. Things like calcium can be very helpful in this situation, specifically for your cardiac patients, because calcium is going to help generate some amount of contractility. And then one thing that I do is, if your pressors are already on, I will actually bolus some pressor, if I'm on epi or levo. And what I'm looking for is a change in their blood pressure. Because if I have them on 5 of levo and their blood pressure doesn't change, say in the ICU, and I give a bolus of 5 mics and their pressure still doesn't change, as soon as I go to induce and intubate them, their pressure is going to drop into the toilet. And so I will actually push pressure and increase my pressure until I see a reaction. Because if you think that this is your blood vessel, in order to get, and it's filled halfway up, say you're empty, if you squeeze down a little bit, you're still halfway or three quarters empty, you're not going to see a rise in pressure. And so it means that if I dilate them, I'm going to absolutely send them into the toilet. So I will intentionally push pressure, go up on my drips until I see that I've squeezed them enough to increase their blood pressure, because as soon as I induce them, as soon as I put them on positive pressure, I know I'm going to drop their pressure. If you have a patient that's super dry and it's not cardiogenic, they need volume beforehand. And a lot of people will rush to intubate if patients are altered. It's like, oh, they're altered. It's like, the guy's 75, he's been vomiting for 3 days, his eyes are sunken, you gave him a liter of fluid back, not 3 liters yet, and you go to intubate him. Well, what happens? There's no venous return to the right side of the heart, they arrest. So I want to make sure that I try to almost get it into a position where I know what's going to happen when you induce an intubate. You drop your preload, you drop your blood pressure, 100% of the time. What can I do to counteract those effects? I can give some amount of volume, and I can support their pressure and inotropic support. And I'm just looking for that inflection point. How much is it going to take to make them maintain their blood pressure? Because I know it's going to, I know it's going to drop.
Okay.
I think that's awesome, right? Because so often we talk about like giving push dose pressors to bridge them onto an infusion. But I like what you're saying. Like, this is kind of the opposite, right? Yeah, you might be giving them push dose. Yeah, you're going to, you know, get them onto a drip, but you're actually then giving them additional push dose in order to kind of, like you said, reach that inflection point and start seeing that effect.
It will start them as soon as I walk into a room in an ICU. If they're not on an infusion, if they're already not on Levo and they need to be intubated, the first thing is start Levo at 5, start Levo at 8 while we're prepping, and I want to see what happens to the pressure. Because if it doesn't move, it means that there is no volume in the tank. And as soon as I do anything, they're going to cry. So I'm using it as my measuring stick to see how much it's going to take for them to not completely, you know, crap the bed.
Yeah. That's awesome. So interesting. So you may, obviously, you know, we talk about, you know, Levo is kind of like our go-to as well, push presser. But you mentioned calcium. So are you... Are you thinking about using calcium kind of preemptively in these patients in order to kind of give them out a little bit inotropic bump to kind of, like, as you put it, kind of combat the negative effects of intubation?
Not just in intubation, but in general, you know, patients end up hypocalcemic to some degree, especially those in heart failure. Calcium is a very potent vasoconstrictor, although it may be transient, and it's a good inotropic agent because, you know, your heart uses a whole lot of calcium to contract as much as it can. So calcium, you know, can be an immense blood pressure support agent on top of kind of all of this stuff.
That's awesome. That's really cool. You also mentioned like optimizing pH and maybe coming right in and giving them some bicarb. I'm curious, what is your threshold for pH? Because like some guidelines will say 7.2, some will say 7.1. I've even, you know, heard people say 6.8. But I'm curious what your threshold is to go, this patient's acidotic to the point where I need to do something about it right now.
Again, this is going to sound terrible because it's always going to be, you know, hedging to some degree. But I'm not waiting for somebody to be 7 or 6.8 or 6.9 before I'm giving bicarb. If I am in a position, even if their pH is 7.25 and my pressors don't look like they're, I'm on 20 of Levo or 15 of Levo, 0.04 of Vaso, 5.10 of Epi, and their pressure's still not coming up, nobody has died of a pH of 7.5, right? That's not gonna happen. And so I'm going to give them bicarb because getting that pH up is going to help with vascular tone. It's going to help with your pressors. And nobody's going to be like, people will say their pH was 7.2, their blood pressure was low. Why didn't you do anything about it? Nobody's going to be like, their pH was 7.2. Why did you give them bicarb? It's like, because their blood pressure and everything came up.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
But you haven't killed anybody by giving an amp of bicarb when they're already acidotic.
Good to
No, that's cool. I guess one last question with regards to kind of optimizing this physiology before doing the intubation. I'm curious, you know, how do you feel about using BiPAP? And I know obviously we talk about that patient who, you know, they need to be conscious, they need to be alert, they need to be engaged, they need to be able to protect their airway. I'm curious, you know, what your thoughts are with respect to using that, excuse me, that non-invasive, that BiPAP or CPAP to help pre-oxygenate them. And maybe even during that apneic period, or not, obviously not the apneic period, but if you happen to choose ketamine kind of during that immediately pre-induction phase, still keeping them on the BiPAP or CPAP to support their oxygenation.
Yes. So we actually do that. I will, if they have a BiPAP on and they have to be intubated, I will leave the BiPAP on literally until I'm ready to put the blade in someone's mouth. Leave it on because it's the best seal they're going to get. They're getting oxygen. As soon as we push our drugs and our RSI drugs, whatever it is, and mask comes off. But 100% leave, so long as they're there, I leave it on. And again, because it comes down to best case scenario, worst case scenario. Sure. Best case scenario, take it off, you put a non-rebreather and they're like kind of getting 100%. Worst case scenario is they aren't, right? BiPAP, right. So long as you take it off at an appropriate time, they should be as oxygenated as they're going to be.
Cool.
But I think probably one of the most important things about intubations, especially as it comes to things like this, is there is a fear. And this happens with everybody in the OR, residents, tending sometimes, this fear of like, I can't intubate, and panic ensues. Put an oral airway in and mask ventilate. And if you can mask ventilate the person, you have all of the time in the world. Obviously, you'd like an advanced airway. You'd like something that you can't necessarily aspirate around, but it is not the end of the world if you cannot intubate. And the most important thing, I think, beyond anything for any of this stuff is once you go to sleep, if you can mass ventilate with gentle pressure and you're getting end tidal, take a step back, breathe for a second, figure out what the next step of the plan is, see where their pressures are with a little bit of positive pressure and go from there.
Awesome. Are you using Apnoox? Do you use that?
I don't know what that is.
Apneic oxygenation, high flow cannula during the after period.
We just let it go. Some people, you know, if somebody's properly denitrogenated before an operation, that's of normal body habitus, can go 6, 7, 8 minutes without breathing, without dropping their oxygen. So a lot of times we'll just, you know, leave their, nasal cannula on or whatever it is and then go.
Gotcha. Yeah, that's kind of been a big thing in the pre-hospital setting, you know, using that in order to kind of extend that apneic period because we have people who are not optimized, a lot of the time. You know.
Just curious. I think that's part of the most important thing is if you have this patient before getting into that ambulance or before getting in, having a serious discussion with the providers on the other side and saying, listen, as exciting as it is to intubate somebody, I'm sure tomahawk style, you know, from the front and lay down. The question is, like you said, where do you think this patient is going? And if you think in 20 minutes, we're going to be in a very different position, it may be the right thing to do to not.
Yeah. Gotcha. Cool. That's awesome. Kind of hit all the big points that I wanted to kind of touch on for, you know, optimizing that patient before intubation. So that's super good stuff. What else do you have, Hunter?
I guess we don't have to dive in super deep. We were just going to kind of, because we don't ever see this a lot in the rural communities and stuff like that. I don't want to keep you much longer. But as far as when do you feel, you know, when we're flying these cardiogenic shock patients and we're dealing with them, sometimes we have the ability to ask ahead, hey, maybe get the team ready. This guy might need a balloon pump, an Impella, whatever. Where's your kind of threshold if you're in the ICU and you're like, is it, you know, this guy's on 4 pressors, he's still not responding, something like that. When are you deciding like, okay, this guy needs a balloon pump, this guy needs an Impella, but we're not playing around, we got to go.
Yeah, it's usually a pretty quick trigger because we're looking at trends. How do you guys, do you guys have like a handheld kind of ABG or something that can check lactate things kind of?
Yeah. Yeah, so we have the iStat that we use.
Yeah. So I can tell you, say, for like severe mitral regurg, the number one thing you can do is put a balloon pump in because it will decrease the afterload for the LV, help blood flow forward, and at the same time, perfuse your coronaries. You know, so again, etiology does matter. But a lot of times we're looking at the trend. And we have patients that are transported here all the time where we're like, this is what their gases have been. This is where their pH is going. Their lactate is still rising. They're on X, Y, and Z. They're on nitric. And it's like, okay, get them ready to get cannulated and we'll bring them over, you know, or whatever it is along those lines. So a lot of times you're looking at a trend and looking at, you know, are they sliding? Are they getting worse? Have they leveled out? Do we can get by with one more agent? Do we think, oh, they couldn't give nitric oxide over there, but we can get them on nitric oxide and that will help? But on the whole, we are looking at what the trend is going towards. And okay. If they're lactate continuously rising, despite 20 of epi, probably not at that point, you're probably considering it, but 10, 15 of epi, with you're like, oh, you know, and you do another echo, and you're like, the heart is still not moving, you know.
So still, kind of recap that, you're still seeing an organ perfusion is depleting, you're still in a good cardiogenic shock, despite pressor requirement, despite other things that we've been trying, they're probably going to need to get a device.
Yeah.
Okay.
And think about devices, that's a whole other
talk. That's why I said, we'll just keep it light. You know, we'll just scratch the surface.
That's awesome. But
big centers do is, you know, the ability to put somebody on a device and bridge them is a super cool thing that I think will only become more and more mainstream as technology gets better, devices get better, smaller.
Cool.
Definitely.
I don't have anything else. What do you have, Hunter? Anything else?
No, that was really informative and great. And yeah, devices is definitely something we'll chat about someday. But no, that was super helpful. I think even though it's not always the most common thing seeing these cardiogenic shock patients that are decompensated, it's nice to have a game plan. And it was definitely helpful with the innovation and definitely with pressors. So that was sweet. Thank you so much.
Yeah, awesome. No, it's my. I look forward to hopefully doing this again, maybe talking about devices or something in the future. You guys have somebody to ride along with you, let me know.
I'll get in the full cop. We'll work on that. We'll see if we can make that happen. That'd be awesome.
We'll get you up there.
Dr. Kavasar, thank you so much for coming on. This is awesome.
Yeah. I really appreciate it. Keep in touch, and thank you guys so much.
Perfect. Awesome. That sounds great. Guys, stick around for just a little bit. We're going to it's going to be a little bit before we can actually get the QR code up for the ConEd. There was so much packed into this broadcast. We got to go ahead and kind of sift through it, pull out the key parts, put together the quiz. So it'll be up in the next 24, 48 hours. Again, Dr. Kavasar, I cannot tell you how much I appreciate you coming on the show. This was awesome. I'm sure everybody out there is going to love it. So thanks again.
If anybody reaches out or has questions, they can feel free to contact me through Instagram or email or whatever it is. And I'm always happy to talk, get on the phone with whoever. So
yeah. Perfect.
Thank you.
Yeah, where would people go to find you if they want to reach out to you best? What's the best place?
Oh, the Instagram at countbackwardsfrom10 or anesthesiacbf10@gmail.com. It's just anesthesia countbackwards.
Cool.
Cool.
Awesome.
Have a great night, guys. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Have a good night yourself.
That's all we have for this episode of the podcast. We sure hope you enjoyed it. I want to invite you to head over to academy.flycrit.com to check out the rest of our courses. And remember, education is good, but excellence through collaboration is much better. Stay safe and live well, and we'll catch you on the next episode of the Flycrit podcast. Bye for now.